Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. This is Sonny Bunch, culture editor at The Bulwark. I am pleased to be joined today by David Lowry. He is the singer slash guitarist for the bands Campervan Beethoven and Cracker, and he's also the senior lecturer in the music business at Terry College of Business, University of Georgia. I'm really pleased to be joined by David today because he is one of my favorite follows on Twitter, because I don't know a ton about the music business, except... For what I have kind of seen happen to the music business financially over the last few years, last decade or so, really, since the rise of Napster and the decline of album sales and the rise of live touring as essentially the only form of reliable income for a lot of bands. And one of the reasons I really like following David is because he keeps track of what is happening to the middle class musician, you know, not the superstars. Taylor Swift and that sort of person is always going to be fine. But it's the working active musicians who rely on royalties and that sort of stuff who has been hurt the most in recent years. So David, can you just talk to me a little bit about how musicians used to make money and how they don't make money now? That is the thing I am most interested in here.
Right. So when I started in this business, I started with an indie label. We recorded our own record with Campervan Beethoven in 1984. We sort of briefly put it out on a friend's label and then realized we could do it ourselves. And so we started doing that. So even as an indie artist, what we would do is we would put out a record and then we'd go on tour. And touring, we would largely break even. We might make a little money as an indie artist. And then we'd come back home and then wait for our distributor to pay us for those record sales that we had generated, right? And then if you got played on the radio too, you also got what are called public performance royalties as well. And it was sort of tour, generate sales, come back, rest, make another one, mm-hmm. tour, generate those sales, come back, right? And this is kind of the way it worked for a long time. Touring is not very profitable on the indies niche middle class scale. Depends how you do it, but it's not really that profitable, if profitable at all. And like I said, we mostly wanted to break even. Somewhere in the early 2000s, it kind of started to switch, whereby essentially like your recordings were advertisements for your tours, mm-hmm. right? You weren't making any money off of your recordings, or not as much, significantly less. And we sort of switched to touring to sort of make up for that. Now, the thing that happens with that is, one, you go from like a scalable business whereby, you know, you make a recording and then, the recording kind of does the work for you. Copies of those recordings generate your revenue and stuff like that. You don't have to play the song over and over again. You go to a non-scalable business, you know, like a dentist or something like that, whereby suddenly now you have to play the show over and over again. So there are a lot more expenses associated with touring. And so your net proceeds, you know, after you pay those expenses, are actually a lot lower. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've kind of calculated it, if you tour with a minimum sort of touring company, like 2 or 3 people in the crew, maybe 2 people in the crew and 4 musicians on stage or something like that in a van and a trailer, really ultimately, and you're paying for, say, on average $200 people a night, you're really probably making about what we would make if we worked at like an Amazon distribution center, about mm-hmm. $15 an hour.
Okay. Yeah.
So we sort of traded that scalable kind of, business for a non-scalable business, which, you know, kind of going backwards in time. You know, our productivity is going down. So, you know, this is one of the reasons why if you don't get a lot of people on tour, you know, this is the first, you know, sort of in the biggest picture way, this is sort of the first thing that happened to musicians to make it a lot harder.
Yeah. I mean, how are bands today supposed to create that artists, that baseline for artists to have a profitable sort of tour, right? I mean, because this is the big question for me is, you know, when you get rid of the album sales and when you say, you know, well, all of this music on the internet, it's just exposure, you know, to, you know, how do you eat exposure? You know, what does this actually do to the actual working musicians?
Right. Well, most of them have other jobs now. Like I was very fortunate in 1986 when we sort of did our first tour and Camper Van Beethoven began to take off, is I could live off of it, you know, being an indie rock band, like that's going around and playing the indie clubs, putting stuff out ourselves. There were like five of us who basically lived off of that. Now, I was always paranoid it was going to go away. So I kept my job at this farm, being their fill-in truck driver, which I did until I was signed to Virgin Records, you know, and had a proper record deal. So I was a little weirder than that. But I mostly now see most young indie niche musicians, they plug themselves into a job like I did with that, where they plug themselves usually into a restaurant, a studio, a bar job where they can kind of come and go because they're not making a living off of it. They may be making money, you know, some money while they're on tour, but they don't make a living off of it. And then making the record is another problem because I think a lot of artists are actually literally taking their bar tips and making their albums with that, right? You know? I mean, yes, you can record at home, but you still, you know, there's competition among musicians and for sonics and the, you know, how your records sound and stuff like that. Right. And that you inevitably hire the skilled professionals, the mixers, the engineers, the mastering engineers and stuff like that. So there's still actually a lot of costs associated with recording. Sure.
Let's talk a little bit about licensing and kind of how that works, because the reason I had actually reached out to you is because I saw you tweeting about how TikTok is essentially stealing music and letting people, you know, record videos with whatever music they want, which again, like, that's the sort of thing that a movie studio has to pay a license for to use in a movie. If Audi wants to put that in their car commercial, they have to pay for it. So everybody talks about podcasters, right? I was going to ask, you know, what would it actually cost me if I wanted to just license the first like 15 seconds of Teen Angst, the cracker song Teen Angst? What would that actually, you know, cost me if I was to do it legitimately as opposed to just slapping it onto the beginning of one of my shows?
Right. So, I don't know. I mean, if you were branding your podcast with that, we'd probably ask for like, we'd probably ask for like $1,000, but then, you know, you also have to get it from Universal Music Group, the recording, and they probably just don't do anything for less than $5,000 just because that's what it costs to draw up the contract. Mm-hmm. You, though, should your distributor of your podcast, though, should pay performance fees. So there actually is. So, like, I'm not 100% positive about this, but somehow I get royalties for podcasts, and I think it's your podcast distributors are actually performing the music, so they're paying it. So that would be Apple, right. Spotify, et cetera. Yeah.
So that would be like getting royalties from radio play?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Because in theory, it's probably a weird loophole. It's probably not perfect to pay a performance royalty because you actually are making a copy. But it's, you know, typically somebody, when they listen to a podcast, they're listening like radio. So I think in general, but like BMI and ASCAP are sort of like unions of songwriters. They just sort of go, oh, well, it's a public performance and we're glad to take the money for it and just sort of treat it like radio. So, you know,
yeah, See, this is already spiraling way out of control. You know, $1,000 to you, $5,000 plus. You know,
well, I know.
But doing it legitimately again is like this is how people used to get paid. This is how people, you know, and frankly, this is how it should work. You know, if a musician makes a song, then you should pay for it if you want to use it as part of your product. But again, this is not happening with like TikTok, and I know there was a big fight with YouTube and Spotify and a bunch of the rest of them, but can you talk to me just a little bit about how that has kind of evolved and has shaken out over the last year or two here?
Yeah, so TikTok came up, and you know, think about TikTok. Actually, what's interesting about TikTok is it's not necessarily letting their users pick the music. They actually have a sounds tab where they are providing songs I've written to their users to use for videos. And they've got some licenses now, but when I started writing about this, they didn't have any licenses for my music. And I mean, you know, there's sort of these valuations going with TikTok of like 30 billion, 50 billion, you know, and stuff like that. They have some licenses in place now, but they are doing their damnedest to really not to get away with licensing as little music as possible. They have these opt-in licenses, which is, you know, this is the way a lot of technology firms tend to look at this. They don't look at this like the way you would look at things in normal liberal democracies, right? Their idea is, well, hey, if you want to get paid, we have these licenses and sign them, rather than I'm going to ask you first before I use my music, you know, your music.
Right.
Like that. They've sort of, you know, this is the way sort of, this goes back to Napster, you know, it's sort of the MO of all technology companies. So I don't know if your listeners know, but, you know, I also led the class action. I filed the first class action and they were combined later against Spotify and Rhapsody Napster for, again, using independent songwriter songs without licenses and not paying royalties. And that settled, you know, and such. So when I saw TikTok come along, I thought, here we go again, right? But I don't know. I mean, yeah, it's just, this is really, really frustrating to me. That's why, you know, you know, not to toot my own horn here, but, you know, I thought about when I saw TikTok, I was like, here we go again. What can we do? What else is there that we can do here? And so when, you know, there became these national security concerns about TikTok's data gathering, which, by the way, if you look up some of the deconstructs of the TikTok app, it's pretty outrageous.
Yeah. Just what the data they're grabbing. I mean,
yeah,
it's
crazy. There's no reason they need to be doing that. I would say it makes more sense that it is a foreign state gathering data that they're going to figure that they're going to gather. They're going to find useful one day. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is honestly how TikTok kind of first popped onto my radar, aside from like the random videos I would see on Twitter, since Twitter killed Vine stupidly. But I all of a sudden it's like, wait, why is this Chinese firm grabbing all of this data? I mean, this is not, why are people putting this on their phones? You know, don't do that.
Like one of the things it does, I was reading this German sort of guy who deconstructs apps. His thing is like he had all these weird questions is, why does TikTok play this tone through your phone really quickly and then re-record it? And it's sort of, the idea was that it was some kind of fingerprinting your device, right? So even if it couldn't get the data just by simply doing that, oh, here's this fingerprint again, you know, it does all kinds of odd things.
Yeah.
So if you've been in the, you know, been around for like 35 years or whatever like that, you meet some interesting people. And I met some interesting people that were in the State Department and then also on the NSC. So this time I just wrote a letter and I'm like, hey, while you're at it, you know, there's probably a few billion dollars worth of value that American intellectual property was used to create TikTok with no licenses, you know? And
yeah.
I don't know whatever became of the CFIUS, which is a good name. CFIUS is a mysterious committee, right? So I don't know ever what became of that, but I was kind of hoping maybe songwriters would get a settlement out of that, because it was built on music, and virtually none of the music was licensed. There were a few licenses out there, but virtually none of it was.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about your lawsuit against Spotify and the rest, Napster and Rhapsody and all those? Because it's a really interesting story that I think a lot of people, again, most people are sitting there listening to Taylor Swift or, Metallica or whoever, right? And they're, I'm showing my age. Those are like the only, I'm trying to, but the independent artists did not have, these deals through their labels to kind of make the money off that. So could you explain the lawsuit and also like how it ended up getting settled and what the financial ramifications were of that?
Yeah. So what it was is it wasn't that Spotify. So, okay. So look, you can get a license for streaming any song you want, cover any song you want. And I can't say no. Mm-hmm. They're called federal compulsory mechanical licenses, right? There's sort of a rationale for it, although I think it's sort of worn out. But the idea is that you can get this federal compulsory license, but you have to go through certain steps. You have to notify the owner of the composition, and that's to sort of demonstrate you know who owns it and who to pay, right? Mm-hmm. And then I know that you're using it, right? And then you have to account on a regular basis. There's all these rules about it and stuff like that, right? Well, when Spotify came out, I saw a lot of people complaining about, sort of the amount that they were getting from their labels, but that's kind of, that's a hard, everybody's contract is different, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But what I focused on was my songwriter royalties, right? And I couldn't find them. I have administrators and I have some co-publishing with Warner. So it's kind of a bit complicated. So I go, they must be just paying the wrong person. And I spent about 2 years looking around and I couldn't ever figure it out. Finally, I'm like, hey, they're not paying me. And every independent songwriter that I knew couldn't find their mechanical royalties either. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so we came to the conclusion after a little back and forth that they did not have licenses. And what they've been doing is kind of buying people off one by one as this sort of came up. Mm-hmm. They literally had
as people were complaining to them, mm-hmm. they would just cut a check to the individual who had figured out that they were getting, not paid.
Yeah, like for instance, at some point, a record label out of Chicago, forgetting the name, punk label, had complained about it. And, and then suddenly all the stuff was back on there. So there must have been some sort of settlement and the back money was paid. But I mean, we just couldn't find it. And it seemed to be a very widespread problem. So the thing, I could have done a lawsuit or got a settlement, probably got six figures or something from them. Because, I just had the data down cold. All my music was registered. It was just up and close, right, for me. Mm-hmm. But I thought I'd go the class action route, just because it just seemed like there was a lot of people out there who didn't get their royalties. Same time, a few other people launched lawsuits at the same time. They eventually were all combined, and eventually Spotify settled for $43 million, although it's actually higher because of how the settlement works. Mm-hmm. And if you filed, it was actually pretty good money that most independent songwriters got from doing this, from this class action. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, it was like, I felt like it was a shot across the bow to the whole industry to get this figured out. So what quickly came on the heels of this settlement was the Music Modernization Act, that in theory was a compromise between songwriters and, songwriters can record performers sign deals with record labels. Songwriters sign deals with publishers. Like publishers are like record labels for songwriters. Right? Mm-hmm. So it was sort of a compromise between publishers, songwriters, and the streaming services. We got some gives, and we got some things from them, and they got some things from us. One of which was they could just get a blanket license, which is instead of notifying every songwriter, they just had to notify the copyright office. So starting January 1st, music's licensed a different way, right? Mm-hmm. For streaming services. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that's happened from this lawsuit is that, I mean, you know, there's only a handful of copyright reform legislations, you know, I mean, there was probably like 30 or 40 of them since the founding of the Republic, but maybe that's not a handful, but that's pretty good.
No, that's good. Congress passes a bill, you know. It's hard to get Congress to pass just about anything these days. So that's a big win. I mean, this is almost too basic for you to explain to people, but could you just talk a little bit about the difference between how songwriters get paid versus how performers get paid? Because again, this is a thing I think a lot of people don't understand when they're looking at, you know, what used to be album liner notes, right? The credits there have like actual huge financial implications in terms of who gets writing royalties versus who gets performance royalties.
Right. So most of the time we're accustomed to, you know, especially in like genres of rock and country like that, you're assuming the person who's singing the songs and performing the songs have written, at least co-written the songs, right? Mm-hmm. So like if you have a record that comes out, it plays on the radio, there's actually two pieces of copyright that you're listening to. You're listening to a copyright for the sound recording, which is generally owned by the record label. And then you're listening to the copyright of the composition, the song in abstract, right? You can, people can make covers of my song, and so you get songwriting royalties for the composition and you get artist royalties for the recording. And sometimes those are separate people. You know, some of my songs, like I wrote one song with my roommate from college, you know, they're not bound by the recording contract.
Right.
You know, so that songwriting royalties are separate and they somehow go to him, you know? So there's two things that are happening there. Now, the neat thing about songwriter royalties is generally if you were a performer and you had a record deal, and this is just the way most record deals work, is that, you know, your share of the, you know, it's the same way movies are recouped or unrecouped, right? All the expenses of making the record and usually like half of the promotion expenses and videos and things like that are actually paid out of the artist's share of royalties, right? So generally when you're an artist, even if you're kind of successful, you spend a lot of time being unrecouped, right? Yeah, performers are unrecouped on their recording projects, largely because, just the way the deals are structured, right? I may get a $400,000 advance to make a record, spend most of it on the record, keep the rest for myself. That's the old days, actually. It's probably more like 50 now. And but then there's like all these promotional costs associated with that, stuff like that. You pay for that. So the great thing about being a performer songwriter is your songwriter royalties are separate. So usually you got those and lived on those, right? So the classic deal that you're, if you had a good manager and a good attorney, they would keep your deal so that you were always unrecouped. Okay, this seems a little weird.
Yeah.
Unrecouped on the recording side, but you were making tons of songwriter royalties, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's basically if you're unrecouped, you get paid more than you're worth. You have to sort of be a quant to think about that a little more. But you don't want to be too unrecouped.
This is like algebra.
Yeah.
This is quadratic equations and stuff.
Exactly. But the idea is you get paid if you're unrecouped a little bit, or even like $600,000, like I was at the end of my Cracker deal with Virgin, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's reasonable, and they just keep you there, and they keep giving you advances to make records, and they you keep earning the songwriter royalties. So the songwriter royalties are important because they never get recouped.
Okay.
Or if you have a good lawyer, they never get recouped. Most people don't do that. So that's actually very important that you get paid for those for essentially writing the book or writing the screenplay, right?
Mm-hmm.
You get paid for that
right.
part of it, and that's a separate copyright. You know, that's
okay.
They make the movie from that, right?
Okay.
I should have done that from the beginning, actually.
Right.
Okay?
Right. So this would be like if I'm just trying to think, you know, Christopher Nolan makes a movie, right? And he would be able to sell the rights to republish the screenplay. As opposed to Warner Brothers getting the money from ticket sales and that sort of thing.
Right, exactly.
Is that okay?
Yeah. So
interesting.
So it's an important thing. But the problem with that is that your songwriter royalties are subject to these compulsory licenses. So, you know, compulsory license means two things. One, you have to license under certain situations. But two, there is an obscure three-judge panel in the Library of Congress that sets our royalties for 5 years at a pop.
Mm-hmm.
And they got it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, songwriters' royalties have been set essentially in that manner since 1909. Well, not exactly in that manner, but they've been fixed by the federal government mm-hmm. since 1909.
Oh, that's interesting. So how does that actually work? I mean, do they sit there and crunch a bunch of numbers and say, okay, this is how much everybody should be getting paid for each you know performance of this song, or right. how does that actually work?
Well, the party subject to this regulation go before these three administrative judges and present evidence. Although it's a little bizarre because they don't really let songwriters. Well, actually, that's not true. This is really great songwriter in Nashville who's basically tested the limits of the administrative state and has finally got himself to present. He personally, as a songwriter, has managed to present evidence directly to that panel of judges. But for a long time, it was the streaming digital streaming services, record labels, and publishers mm-hmm. Presented all that evidence there. And they have their own economists, and basically they try to arrive at a free market rate for songwriter royalties, even though there's no actual free market, never mm-hmm. has been one. So it's a little Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
If you take, I mean, it's sort of, it's rational, and I suppose if you forget that you've gone down a rabbit hole, you know,
yeah.
You know what I mean? So the last round of settling, I took some notes here, that in 2020, we were supposed to get 13.1% of the streaming services gross revenue prorated per song per stream. Right.
Okay. Okay. Sure.
So if you had all 100 streams on this is the world's stupidest streaming service. It just had one of my songs
mm-hmm.
and it only had 100 streams for that month, you would get 13% of the revenue. I would get all 13% of that. Right.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay.
And,
sure.
And that generally works out for the songwriter to something like about 8 to 9/100ths of a penny per stream.
Right.
So if you're keeping count, it's like a, you know, it's really small.
Right, right. Well, so how does this compare to like radio play?
Well, I did the math on it one time. Now, remember radio? Were you ever in radio?
I've always listened to radio.
Right.
I've never worked in radio.
Right. Okay. So audience metrics are highly inflated and BS. Right.
BS. Okay. Right? Sure.
It's usually, you know, a radio station has some sort of audience rating, and that's kind of over the course of 24 hours. Somebody skimmed by, maybe listened to one song on your station mm-hmm. or something. I don't know exactly how it works, but I know it's highly inflated. I actually tried to do the math on that by taking the royalties that one commercial radio station in a tertiary market, I don't remember which one, it was like Fort Collins, Colorado or something like that. And
mm-hmm.
It was about 400% higher than what you get from streaming services. Okay. And even that was kind of questionable because I was using their metrics, which are highly inflated. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's hard to say, but it's definitely a lot lower than commercial radio. I mean, last quarter I got $1,600 for my songwriting on American commercial radio. Across all my songs, across all commercial airplays, whereas I probably got 30 from YouTube.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. That's crazy.
I probably got 300 maybe from Spotify, something, or Apple. I don't know. Usually it's like 10, 20 times higher from YouTube to Apple.
Yeah. I mean, just thinking about, you know, how people listen to music now, radio versus Google versus, mm-hmm. you know, YouTube, I guess, which is owned by mm-hmm. Google, but versus Spotify. I mean, that just is, That's insane to me. What those numbers look like. Let me shift gears slightly here and ask and go back to the touring question, because you know we live in obviously a very weird time right now. The age of COVID. Mm-hmm. People can't actually go on tour. You know, people are essentially relying on album sales and streaming sales and that mm-hmm. sort of things to make a living right now. Is that even possible now at this point in our musical financial history? I mean, the idea that a band can't go out there and tour almost seems like a death sentence.
Yeah,
like a fiscal death sentence.
Well, certainly for certain niche genres, I think jazz is completely unsustainable. Mm-hmm. Blues is probably unsustainable. A lot of traditional American art forms are not sustainable anymore. I'd say any rock band that plays for less than, on average, this means that, you know, this counts your Monday night in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I always pick on Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's a great town, though. Long, great musical history. But we never do well there. So, so this means that, you know, from your New York to your Tulsa, Oklahoma in the same week, if you're doing 300 or 400 a night, you probably make a living without another job, you know, 4 or 5 people in the band, maybe, mm-hmm. maybe, I don't know, but that's average across every night. So that means, you know, you're doing 1500 people in New York and you're doing, you know, 150 in Tulsa, Oklahoma on the Monday night. Right. So, and there's only so many places you can play without, you know, essentially so many shows you can play a year before you start cannibalizing your own ticket sales. Right. So mm-hmm. it doesn't really work. Like a few years ago, I had a really good friend. He's been a concert promoter forever and he managed us, co-managed us for a while. And he goes, you know, instead of playing 160 shows a year, why don't you try playing 40? And I bet you make as much money. Right. And he wasn't quite right, but he was pretty right. I was close mm-hmm. enough that mm-hmm. I learned my lesson about that. Like, yeah, I actually got to play less shows. So this is the formula that we've come up with, right? And it's really funny. It's borrowing essentially from the movie business. It's borrowing some sort of windowing things. So in the last year, the formula we've come up with that helps us play shows and you know, basically have some money to live on is I make records that I sell only at the shows. Like I'll make 1,000 copies of solo record. I sell it at the shows only, right? Before I put it onto digital services, right? Mm-hmm. And that'll give me like, and I charge a premium. And there's no, I'm a specialty product. Why shouldn't I charge $30 for a CD, you know, right?
Sure.
Something like that. By the way, actually CDs are the best invention ever because they're so cheap to make. And everybody still has a CD player, or maybe they don't now. It's getting a little long in the tooth, but it used mm-hmm. to be way better than vinyl. People were trying to do this with vinyl. Vinyl costs so much to make, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so one of the things we've been doing is like I've been releasing these records on top of a tour, and so have my bandmates. Well, also largely we've been doing solo records because these are kind of, you know, cheaper to make, and you know, there's no fighting over the money, you know, it's just like, yeah, I sold 200 CDs at the show. That's my money, you know, right?
Yeah.
So that's one thing we did is we basically created a theatrical window, right? Mm-hmm. And then what I do next is then I go to, you know, view on demand, which or not really view on demand, but, you know, sales, digital sales,
sure,
right?
Sure, sure. Digital downloads, right?
Digital downloads, right? We do that for a while. And then kind of when you've taken most of the demand and you can do those things directly, right?
Right. You do them just through your website or
through your website or Bandcamp or even like there's some no fee distributors now that are interesting, but I think they're owned by the majors. They're taking your data. And then sort of the at the tail end, then you put it onto streaming services. Now that works for established legacy acts, established bands that already have an audience. I mean, if you're a new band, you got to, I don't know what you do. You just got to give it away. Get somebody's rich parent to finance you. I don't know how you do it. You know, was that over? Your show was
yeah. Good. Well, Well, no, so this is really interesting, but how does that work right now when nobody can go on tour?
Well, that's what I mean.
It just seems like, you know, a kind of apocalyptic nightmare
right
out there for, you know.
So what I'm going to do, this is my last solo one I did. I sold for $25 on tour. You know, I sold 1,000 copies and then I moved it to digital. So, you know, it doesn't sound like much, but like,
again,
considering that record.
Right. Like you say, it's like a theatrical window. Yeah. There's a premium that you charge mm-hmm. to show it in theaters. And then then you can show it to people at home for slightly cheaper. And then it goes to, you know, HBO or TNT or whatever.
Well, so for my new record, I planned to release it here in our December, January tour that we always do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of the other guys in Camper had a release, you know, put together, but we don't have that. So we had to lose that window. So we're going to sell it off of our website and digital at the same time. And it's not going to be as good. It's going to mm-hmm. be like that window, instead of being like, that window is not going to be $25,000 for me, you know, which pays for my time to make a record and the cost
sure.
and paying my musicians and engineers and stuff. Right. It's gonna be like 5 or 7 or something like that. And, mm-hmm. and so that kills that. But that's, you know, okay, look, $24,000 on a CD. That's like, I think I calculated this recently. It's 100 million views on YouTube, which I don't know who gets that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
Really big stars. It's about 6 on Spotify, I think is what it is, or 7 on Spotify.
7.
Yeah.
7 million.
Yeah, something like 7 million on Spotify streams, and about 3.5 or 4 on Apple Music.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest are sort of fall between those three extremes. But that's 99% of your streaming market right there. So,
right, right.
So, you know, that will take years. I mean, if I consider a recurrent hit, like my 99% of my revenue comes from basically 5 songs
mm-hmm.
That I wrote. And so like Low usually gets 8 or 9 million streams across the big streaming services a quarter. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, here I'm putting out a solo album later in my career, not radio hits, you know, I don't know if those will ever get to the 8 or 9 million streams on streaming services.
Yeah.
Maybe they will.
Yeah. So Low is still bringing in a decent amount of revenue, even with the, decreased royalties from streaming. It's still doing okay for you?
Yeah. Well, here's the interesting thing. Look, first of all, I have all those streams because, you know, a big record company, you know, Virgin Records,
mm-hmm.
Basically put millions of dollars into my two bands over a number of years, right? And they mm-hmm. built kind of a brand, and then they had some hits that are recurrents, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have some hits that are recurrent off of all of that, right? Okay, so I can't say that streaming actually necessarily pays the right amount for Cracker because there was all this initial investment up front. But weirdly, streaming's kind of a wash for Cracker.
Okay.
But for Camper Van Beethoven, it's a disaster, right?
Okay.
Because I have this incremental revenue on these 5 songs that are long paid off. They're in the catalog. They're generating what we call bathtub money. Maybe you call it the same in the movie business, but you're sitting in the bathtub and your check arrives in the mail. You know, you're like, oh, that's a good day's work.
Yeah, sure.
But you have these songs that are doing that. So weirdly, and this gets into the thing about streaming that nobody understands, is that going to a flat rate per spin was actually a really stupid idea. Of course, I don't know what the alternative would have been, but it's actually a really stupid idea because what it ends up doing is it ends up sort of overpaying you on the hits and underpaying you on like all sort of the niche stuff and the album tracks or the niche genres and all of that stuff, because you have fewer streams to break down your fixed costs over, right? So you know, in the normal economy, like a niche product always costs more than a mainstream product. Your rock mount hand stitched Western wear shirt, $150, from the store, $250 if you get a really good one, right? Versus, the semi ironic American flag t-shirt, printed made in Cambodia and shipped over in containers, right? That could be $5, right?
Yeah, right.
You just flat pay per stream means you overpay the hits and you underpay everything else.
Right.
And in the old days, everybody goes, but albums all cost the same when it was vinyl albums, right? They actually didn't. They sort of had a list price. And like if you were a niche artist, you didn't. I mean, unless you were trying to get more popular or something like that, generate additional sales, you didn't discount. But you would always get a discount on the big stuff. And then places like Best Buy would further discount.
Sure.
Because they were trying to sell, stereo systems and, car stereos.
Trying to get you in the door.
Yeah, right. And then the other thing is, when you buy an album, you're basically buying 1,500 streams up front, right? You get it up front, right?
Right, sure. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of the way we figured it out, right? You buy an album, you buy 1,500 streams up front, whether you use them or not, Ornette Coleman's Science Fiction, I think I've listened to that probably about 20 times in my life, that album, and I don't regret paying for it or anything like that, but I didn't use all 1,500 of those streams, he got a bunch of free streams and that, that basically made the value of each listen was more expensive, right?
Sure.
So you got a flat streaming, you jack the whole thing. It doesn't work the same, And then big records, they would discount them later, like the Columbia Record Club. Ask any performer, that was ever around when they had the Columbia Record Club. Sure. Where are your royalties from the Columbia Record Club? They were very similar to Spotify royalties, right?
That's interesting. Yeah,
they were really, really low. There's a thing called a mid-price 3/4 rate where they just slash everything 3/4, your songwriter royalties, everything like that. But when it goes to the record club, it's not even really a mid. It's like almost like a cutout, It's like it's a very minimum royalty on those record clubs.
I had no idea about that. That's interesting.
So really, streaming you should put in the record club category. which brings me to my one point that I want to make, since this is largely about the movie business. I was kind of horrified to see that. I've always said to my friends, it's like we should do things more like the movie business. It's they get the better lawyers, from the better law schools, that they've got more money. They've got to be doing this better. But then I see that, is it Warner? Just like it's just taken everything straight to streaming, no theatrical.
What Warner's is doing is taking their entire 2021 slate and releasing it in theaters and on HBO Max, their streaming service, simultaneously.
Right. So they're trying to build a platform, right?
Right. So they're basically trading a year's worth of theatrical revenue for, adding 20 or 30 million subscribers to HBO Max.
But, if the movie business did that, you would never... It would be a disaster, just like for the music yes. business, because you don't get, look, the okay, so a friend of mine, I've worked with him for a long time. He releases our records in the rest of the world. It's this company called Cooking Vinyl, Martin Goldschmidt. He's really, really smart. So I called him up to do an artist rights symposium for my students, right? Have him talk. And one of the students said, how are you doing during streaming, because we heard that people aren't listening to as much music. They stopped streaming music and started streaming video, right? He goes, well, it doesn't really matter because streaming services essentially pay X amount per subscriber per month, so it never changes, right? Mm-hmm. So essentially what we did with the music business by going to streaming was another thing that we did is it doesn't matter if something's viral. It doesn't matter if you have a few big blockbuster hits, because you essentially, once you're a record label or distributor of a certain size, you kind of got a pretty stable percentage of that pool of streaming revenue every month. And it's the same whether people listen a lot or whether they listen, a little. And then you got to wonder, Universal Music Groups with things like Taylor Swift or Beggars with Adele and stuff like that, if they put their big artist onto streaming, they essentially Bigfoot themselves. Mm-hmm. They just take the revenue that they were getting anyway, and mm-hmm. it just goes to Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
You know, because companies like Universal Music Group have something like 40% of the streams. You know, I think Warner's down at like 15 and mm-hmm. Sony somewhere in the middle. You don't. So.
Right.
Without like theatrical or sales on there, this is weird. It's a really weird business now.
Yeah. I mean, but. How are the major studios making, or the major labels making their money then, if they're kind of cannibalizing themselves this way?
I don't think anybody's really figured that out yet. The two friends of mine that point this out all happen to work for Soundtrack, do soundtracks for movie studios. Yeah. That's sort of my joke about, like, I think the movie studios are generally smarter, but not necessarily the movie business is generally smarter because it's a lot more money. I don't think anybody's figured that out yet, honestly. You got to imagine that streaming services in the industrialized economies are mature now. They're not going to really mm-hmm. add that many more. I mean, the growth that's coming is coming from developing countries. Like Mexico is, you know, going to be a big, you know, it's a big growth rate right now, right?
Sure.
But Canada, US, UK, right? So you're essentially in the industrialized countries, you're working with a fixed pool of revenue, right? So mm-hmm. if you go back and look at old sales charts, it looked more like the movie business. Like if you go back to, I think it's 1979, I might be wrong on this, in the vinyl era, the per capita revenue for music in the United States like jumps like from like 47 to like 77 or something one year. But mm-hmm. if you go back and look at it, it's like Pink Floyd album, Led Zeppelin album, disco was still big. You know what I mean? It was mm-hmm. like you had these big albums. It dragged people in the stores. They bought other albums, right? You get this viral, you can get like viral demand on records and stuff like that. And you just cut all that off now.
Yeah.
If you use only streaming.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, this has always been kind of my worry, looking at what happened to the music business and watching the film business make essentially the same mistakes over again. I think they have a little more control over it because there isn't that, there's Pirate Bay and whatever, but there isn't that kind of viral Napster phenomenon where an entire generation just says, screw it, we're just going to download music now.
Right.
And there hasn't been that breakage yet. But I do worry looking at the movie business and just thinking like, well, you know, you guys have a lot of advantages here. Why are you throwing them all away to try and compete with Netflix? It doesn't make a ton of sense to me.
Well,
Am I wrong? Are you because you sound exactly like how you sound like a much smarter and more organized version of what I think to myself when I you know, kind of look at these studios making these decisions.
Yeah. I mean, I think the same thing. Why? I think it's because, I don't know. You get me all started on this. Capital's really cheap right now. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. if you're like, you can borrow money. Well, you borrow money from the Chinese because they want to have influence over this too. That's another crazy thing is that, you know, the Tencent bought parts of the streaming other streaming services and then bought like 20% of Universal Music Group. Mm-hmm. Okay. So those things look more profitable than they are because, you know, based on revenue versus interest rates, they seem really valuable, like really good investments. But if interest mm-hmm. rates ever went back to something kind of normal or, I don't know what's normal anymore, but would Spotify be worth? I mean, how can Spotify be worth almost as much as, you know, the entire music business, right?
Right.
Like 40 billion or something like that. Maybe not. I mean, so I think those businesses those valuations are not sustainable or. You know, the streaming services like both video and music or the underlying assets are wildly undervalued. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing about, you know, mispricing. You never know if it's this is mispriced or that's is this underpriced or is that overpriced, right? So I think there's a whole generation of executives have come up that basically see valuation as profit.
Yeah.
And they're pushing out, they've never had experiences with real net profit businesses, and they're pushing out all the younger generation has come in and is pushing out the older music business or film business executives and stuff like that. And I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think there's another angle to this in the film world, which is, they have no idea right now how to pay artists like royalties and stuff, right? So the residuals on streaming are very different than they are for DVD sales or you know, plays on TV or whatever. And then, you know, on top of that, you also have the you have no profit participation really on like a Netflix movie, right? Mm-hmm. You don't get 5% of first dollar gross if you're Will Smith. You instead just get $20 million up front, and that's it, or $30 million up front, whatever he got paid for Bright. It's just interesting, and there's a lot of different angles to this that I think again are very similar to what has happened to the music business and what is continuing to kind of happen there. All right, we're running a little bit long.
Sorry,
this is a little longer.
Yeah.
No, it's fine. It's great. This is a great, interesting conversation. Is there anything? I always like to close by asking if there's anything I should have asked. If there's anything you think people should know about what we've been discussing today. I think. You know, what did I foolishly fail to ask?
I think you actually got it. I mean, these are the things I had public. Yeah, I mean, we kind of got all of this stuff in there at one point or another. I mean, I wished actually one time we do talk about this, but we should talk about. I want to revisit Napster versus Metallica one point,
okay.
Because if you look at the Charlie Rose show, where was it? Professor Griff and Lars Ulrich were both on there.
Okay.
Everything Lars says comes true. It's like he's it's like he's reading from a crystal ball or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I'll find that and I'll link to it in the the show notes because it's interesting. I always thought Lars got a bum rap. Mm-hmm. From music fans and, like, frankly, other artists too, when he was, you know, kind of pointing out that Napster is the death of the music industry.
Well, you know, we around my blog toyed with just calling him Saint Lars all the time, just to troll everybody.
Yeah.
He was like a martyr saint, you know. It was like, it's funny.
He was right. He was ahead of his time.
That's right.
Great. Well, thank you very much for being on the show, David. I really appreciate it. Is there anything you want to plug? Can we tell people the website where they can go buy your albums?
DavidLowryMusic.com or Bandcamp. January 1st at exactly 12 midnight, I am releasing a new album. I didn't want anything in 2021. Right. So you can get it then. I'm gonna live stream it, I think, too, on Facebook and YouTube. If you follow my page on Facebook, I don't even actually, my wife runs it, but okay. Yeah,
great. Check out his new album, and we will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.